So Geographical Imaginations is out at the bobsled track this weekend. And I want to just introduce something really quickly. We're at the first curve, and the bobsled just started up at the top, at the start. And we just want to welcome you to the show. We're actually going to have a two-man bobsled welcome you to the show. Just motored by us in the first 15 seconds of its run. Welcome to Geographical Imaginations. This is Geographical Imaginations, a show about the geographies of everything and nothing, where each month we ask a question or explore a theme with a wide variety of texts and voices that come together in interesting ways to challenge the way we imagine our geographies, our spaces, and our places in this world. This is episode 5, coming to you from Salzburg, Austria. We call this Winter Wonderland. Tonight, we have two segments. First, we're out in the field at the Königssee Bobsled Luge and Skeleton Track in Bavaria, Germany, one of only 14 or 15 tracks certified for international competition in the world. And in our second segment, we take a critical look at the Olympic host city selection process and budgets for the Olympic Games in a conversation with geographer Dr. Christopher Gaffney of the University of Zurich. Let's head back out to Königssee and listen in as fellow athletes cheer on their countrymen and women at the starting gate in Skeleton. The sounds of bobsled, I think, it's important to point out, not just the sled racing down the track, as we heard in the intro, but at the starting gate to hear fellow teammates, and even across countries, not from the same country, cheering on their competitors at the starting gate. It was there that I found members of Team USA and asked them about their experience. So I'm here with
Annie O'Shea.
From Long Island, right?
Correct.
Excellent. And so you're a skeleton athlete. You raced yesterday and...
I finished 9th, which is a really big, really big achievement for me here.
Yeah. So at this track, you've been here a couple other times, you said?
Yes. So I've been here a few times. I've had a really good crash and it's been pretty difficult for me coming back. But I'm really happy with yesterday.
Yeah. Excellent. Congratulations.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
So how many years have you been with the team?
This is my 9th competitive year.
Oh, wow.
In a while.
What's your athletic background? Like, what got you into skeleton?
I'm a track and field athlete, and I was asked to come out to try skeleton. So I did, and then they asked me to come back. So, and here's Holcomb going, and Justin Olsen. They're both gold medalists from 2010 in the four-man. And this run, I'm really hoping they stay out of the snow. It's pretty stressful watching. Justin and I have been dating for almost 5 years, so I kind of get like my heart pounding when they race and it's not going well or it is going well. It's a little stressful, but he hit a lot of snow there. Let's see how his Kreisel goes. He looks pretty good.
So you look at the line there, right? Is that correct?
You look at the line. Bobsled keeps a straighter line than skeleton can keep. They can control the pressures better than we can, so they'll definitely look a lot more straight through the corner. And he's having a nice bottom, but he's slowly making up time, and I don't know if the track is going to be long enough. And it is! that's awesome.
So
that's
how did he finish, just for our radio audience?
He was in 14th, so he's kept his position. So he's in 14th, and if any sleds fall behind him, he'll move up.
Okay, good. Yeah. And is this another U.S. team?
This is.
Oh, maybe we could look at this team,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, totally. This is our USA 2 sled, currently in 13th. And they just had a 94. That's a pretty good start for them. Definitely almost a 10th faster than their first run. And they're hopefully going to have a good run as well. It would be great if all three of our sleds could just move up. Ooh. Oh, that's horrible out of the down in Bendaway.
Now, is that considered a save, though, by the driver to kind of straighten that out?
He caught it really well, but that skid, especially in the snow going slower, is just going to cost him all this time and speed.
Yeah.
So now he's already back by a lot.
Right.
Stressful.
And it's really, I mean, the sport's a question of milliseconds it's under a second that people are winning by. So any little thing like that affects your final time.
Yeah, and we are timed to the hundredth of a second, and then you think, like, going 70 miles an hour, how much is a hundredth? So it's kind of like, if I just did this, if I just did that, if I made it. And unfortunately, Nick just fell back to number 4, so that puts him in, what was he, what did I say he was, 12th? It puts him in 16th?
Yeah.
Rough.
Yeah. So to continue, I guess, a little bit of your background. So started as a senior in high school and then kind of went back and forth through college with your track and field experience, but also really liking the international sports scene.
Yeah, a lot of it to me was that if I had just competed collegiately, I would have been done competing 4 years later. And I knew for skeleton that I'd have the option, like I would be competing for at least 4 years and then maybe another 4, which it has been another 4 going on, another 4. So I could just see that my love for sports was going to be able to continue it. And that really was nice.
Yeah, it seems like there's a commitment to 4 year segments or 4 year periods of time. And so is this another Team USA here?
This is.
Yeah.
This is our third two-man sled. So this is our USA 3 sled. And he's been having a great season. He's a newer driver. He's one of our younger athletes and just really doing well. And hopefully he can make it through the Bendaway really nice with a good Kreisel. That just says it all on this track is how you do.
Yeah, is this kind of a breakthrough season for him?
This is, yeah. This is his first full World Cup season, and he's been doing awesome in the two-man and four-man. So.
Where is he from?
Cody is from what part? Whitehall, New York. It's more like upstate New York.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, is there a kind of a geography to where people are from? Or do you find most people are from the northern states? Or?
A lot of people, we're kind of all spread out, but there's a good amount of people from, like, the Northeast, also from the West, like, near Utah mainly. And then now with our push athletes, they've been branching out. There's a lot from the South, so they hate the cold. But we're spreading out a lot, which is great.
So a push athlete is someone that's there to push, not driving? Is that?
Yes, the push athlete is also known as the brakeman. So they sit as behind the driver, and then in four-man they sit the second, third, and fourth sled people.
Yeah. Now, the reason, I guess, why people might be from the Northeast or in around Utah is because they're close to training centers. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, in Lake Placid, upstate New York, we have a training center, and it's easy to be able to go there and to train, and you get to live there if you qualify. And then in Utah, it's just the atmosphere. There's another track out there. No training center, but it's the lifestyle for a lot of people.
Yeah, and in terms of, I guess, what I've been looking at is there's only a few world-class tracks for world-class competitions. There's only 14, I think, in the world? Or?
Yeah, 14. Is it 15 now? I forgot adding Sochi. I can't seem to remember. But, yeah, and we only have 8 international races a year plus a world championship, so we only ever end up on 9 of the tracks.
Oh, right. So there's a rotation. They might not be back here again in Bavaria next year.
We keep a very very similar schedule, so we almost always cover all 3 German tracks. We always end up in Austria, Switzerland. Now we've added France on the list all the time. The places that we don't go We don't go to Latvia anymore and Japan. And there's a track in Norway that only skeleton goes to.
And only skeleton goes there, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because this is where the sport started, right, in the Alps. Is this kind of the home country to well, at least bobsled, I guess?
Yeah, I think Germany and Switzerland, definitely the home country. It's just, it's been, I mean, they've been around for so long that it's been the norm and it's what everyone does. You don't just go sledding, you go bobsledding, so.
Right, right. Well, it's nice to be here with you, and I appreciate you talking with us and kind of informing us a little bit about the racing and where Team USA is from, and wish you all the best of luck the rest of this season and into the World Championships this year are in Sochi, right?
The World Championships are in Winterberg, Germany, actually.
Oh, okay, right. Is that there every year? Is that kind of a tradition, or does that rotate as well?
That rotates as well. So they're planned out 4 years in advance. So technically they should be in Sochi next year unless anything changes.
Well, great. Good luck with to you for the rest of the way, and thanks again.
Thank you so much. Great talking with you.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out our website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. To listen to old episodes, they're archived there on the website under the tab Episodes. In tonight's episode, we're talking about bobsled and how it fits into the world of international sport. Let's go back out to Königssee for my first installment of the field notes format. Let's listen to some of the field notes.
So we're here at the two-man bobsled. We're at the intermission right now after the first run. And all the teams are up here at the starting gate, sort of getting warmed up. Start to see the men. This is two-man, the men's two-man. And so the men are starting to run around a little bit to stay warm. It's snowing at a pretty good rate right now, even just during the half-hour intermission. I think maybe it seems like half an inch of snow has fallen. But a chance to maybe think about some of the geography here. I guess I've been always attracted to the sport, and it's part of this geographical imagination that I've been, I guess, has been developing over a long period of time. Growing up in Greater New York in the United States, I can't help but sort of locate the 1980 Winter Olympics as something really important in my early youth, as sort of inspiring me to follow Olympic sports, but specifically Winter Olympic sports. And it's always been the bobsled, I think. Ski jumping, too, a little bit, I think, has kind of been something that I've enjoyed watching. But the bobsled always captured my imagination in ways that I'd have to say I couldn't really put my finger on. But year in and year out, watching early on, it was Jim McKay's Wide World of Sports. And seeing during the winter months the World Cup bobsled races, and then of course the World Championships every year, but looking forward to, I was, the every 4 years the Winter Olympics. First, I guess, was Lake Placid, and I'm remembering places like Lillehammer, most recently obviously Sochi, but Calgary was another place, Salt Lake, Albertville. These are all places that different perhaps from the Summer Olympics, in terms of the Summer Olympics generally are in bigger cities, in more sort of cosmopolitan global cities, if you will. But the Winter Olympics many times take place in small, even small villages. Some of the venues for the skiing, and for this venue here, we're in Königssee in Greater Berchtesgaden, which is in Bavaria. It's very close to Salzburg, where I've been living. We came here today on local bus. We took two local buses and were able to get to this venue coming from Salzburg. But it's these small sort of almost village-like atmospheres or village places that I saw on TV. I always saw these sports, the bobsled, the luge, the tracks that we see, the tubular tracks. I always saw them as being part of the Alpine village. And so that entered into my kind of conceptualization of the world was this Alpine village, and hearing the bells ringing as the bobsleds went by or the luge went by and people cheering. And so it's this small town that kind of becomes global through this sport, through the lens of the TV for most people around the world. In fact, I would count the number of people here at this event as fewer than 1,000. But the number of people being able to watch it on TV and taking this perhaps sport very much local and regional to the Alps, and that's where it started. Its history here in Switzerland, Germany, Austria, northern Italy, the Alpine region, if you will, being sort of the hearth of this sport. Of course, though, having training centers worldwide, most notably, I think of North America, I guess, with Lake Placid being the training center for the United States, and then in Canada as well, having their own training and having had their own Olympics there, Winter Olympics, and hosting that Winter Olympics, having the facilities to practice this, what may have started even as a very regional or local sport, has become worldwide.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, the show about the geographies of everything and nothing.
So we're here at Curve 6. The next bobsled, two-man, is about to start. 1, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. This is how long it takes to go down, and they're down the curves.
So I left Königssee and Curve 6 and the sounds of bobsled, wondering where to go with this winter wonderland. While interested in the poetics of bobsledding, I couldn't help but ask, like in my field notes, about the projection of this regional sport onto the international stage. But even perhaps more importantly, how the international stage is set. I first saw bobsled through the Olympics, the Winter Olympic experience, and that gave me an entryway into seeing parts of the world I'd never seen before. But how is that stage set? What goes into all the production, the television, the dollars that go into hosting an event? Not necessarily this World Cup event at Königssee, but I'm talking more about the every 4 years, the Olympic, the Winter Olympic events, and how large their budgets have become over the years, and how much is it really about the host city? And so I tracked down a geographer who's working precisely on that, on the politics and budgets of mega events. Dr. Christopher Gaffney, who received his PhD in geography from the University of Texas, and was taught at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. In 2009, Gaffney received the Fulbright Scholarship to study the urban and social impacts of the World Cup and Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. From 2010 to 14, he was visiting professor in the Graduate School of Architecture and Urbanism at the Universidad Federal Fluminense. Gaffney's research has focused on social movements in the context of mega events, the urban dynamics of Rio de Janeiro, and the political economy of football. Much of this research was tied to a three-year national-scale research project hosted at the Universidad Federal do Rio de Janeiro that investigated the impacts of the World Cup in the 12 Brazilian host cities. His current research projects are focused on a mapping of social, political, and economic actors that are shaping the 2016 Olympics. Beginning in 2015, Gaffney assumed the editorship of the Journal of Latin American Geography and has recently moved to Zurich, where he is a senior research fellow in the Department of Geography. It's from there he joins us. So first off, welcome to the show, Chris. Thanks for joining us. My first question is about this process. How does a country or a city become host of the mega event, like the Winter Olympics or the World Cup?
Yeah, well, it's a multi-stage process, typically, and it's shifted a lot in recent years, and there are big differences between the World Cup and the Olympics. The World Cup is a bit simpler in that countries bid and not cities. In the Olympics, it's always a city that has the support of their National Olympic Committee. The World Cup bidding, a lot of different countries throw their names in the hat, and FIFA basically picks one out. And how FIFA picks that out is a murky world of mafia dealings and suitcases and back rooms and a lot of obscure transactions and very opaque mechanisms that through which the World Cup gets decided. And so the World Cup is its own special beast. The World Cup has a kind of a diffuse impact because it goes to as many as 12 cities in the case of Brazil, 11 cities in the case of Russia. No one knows exactly what's going to happen in Qatar yet. But the Olympics are quite a different story. We have to pass through, cities have to pass through various stages of candidacy. And so there's the aspirant stage when the IOC does an initial evaluation of as many as 9 host cities. Then they pass to a candidate stage where it's typically narrowed down to 4 or 5. And then the IOC makes its selection 7 years before the event is going to happen. And what we're seeing right now is the selection process for the 2022 games, which will either be in Kazakhstan or China after Oslo pulled out of the bidding process because of a public outcry about expenditures.
And so the IOC winter games we're talking about.
Yeah, right? The winter games.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the summer games, there are various candidates for the 2024 games, Boston being one of them. And we've seen a lot of organic resistance coming from Boston that are really pointing out the economic idiocy of hosting the Olympics and plus the inevitable long-term impacts or short-term impacts as well on traffic and homeless populations and all the negative externalities that come with the preparation of a city to host the Olympics.
Right. Is Madrid still kind of floating around as a possible city?
I think Madrid has stopped. They were their candidates 3 times in a row. They were, and with the financial crisis in Spain, I don't think it's a popular. I think any Spanish government would be foolish to try to suggest that spending billions on hosting the Olympics is any way to revive the Spanish economy. And so I think it would meet with strong organized resistance as it is meeting in other European host cities.
Right.
So it's going to be very difficult for North American and Western European cities to get the billions of public financing that are necessary for hosting the Olympics past an aware and active civil society.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. This is episode 5, Winter Wonderland. Let's get back with Dr. Gaffney to see if hosting the Olympics is really worth it. people think it's an investment, a future in the future. Or at least that's how it's been framed and probably framed for tax-paying populations or citizens, is that this is an investment in the future. Is from your research, are you what are you finding, and what are other people finding in terms of, is this worth it? And the money that's being spent now is astronomically different than, say, you know, this idea from the mid 20th century of putting together an event to bring the world to. I mean, this is now something different, isn't it?
Yeah, it has taken on a gigantism or enormous proportions that are just mind-boggling. In the case of the Sochi Olympics, the Winter Olympics, which are typically much smaller, the final price tag was $50 billion. And they estimate about 50% of that money was lost to corruption and overpricing, and et cetera. Every single games, there's no Olympic games that has come in at less than 175% over budget, including London. And so, you know, the British and their all their accountants and such couldn't keep the costs under $30 billion. The Olympics in Rio will cost about $40 billion, and this is public money. And so what we tend to see is that in the short term, this is a massive transfer of wealth from the public purse to private construction firms, security firms, tourist agencies, hoteliers, etc. And that the promise is that the increase in tourism, that the increased exposure will come back in to the public coffers through increased tax revenue. But then how that tax revenue is then redistributed to the population is never made quite clear. And so we're asked to buy into this Olympic dream to renovate or transform or put the city on the map, as the saying goes, turn the international spotlights on, for a price tag of around 30 to 50 billion U.S., with no guarantee that that money will be recouped in even the medium term, and if it is recouped, how it will be then redistributed to the population that's fronted that money.
Right. I mean, so I guess to go along with that, I had never heard of Albertville before it was a host to the Olympics. I'd never heard of, I never really heard of Sochi, to be honest.
Sure, or Lillehammer.
Lillehammer, I guess that's the best one. That's outside of, Oslo?
Yeah,
so I'd never heard of these places. No one had ever heard of Lake Placid, New York, either. New York, sure, but maybe not Lake Placid.
Sure.
So it does kind of spotlight these otherwise, especially the Winter Olympics. I think there's a big difference between the Winter, not always, but it's sometimes almost in a town or village kind of atmosphere, as opposed to the Summer Olympics tend to be maybe more mega cities, big cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yes, and of course you also do this with the World Cup. You put a World Cup stadium in a city like Cuiabá, which most people have never heard of and they'll never hear of again.
Right.
As well. And so you get a temporary moment in the international media. But then what? What do you do with that? And unless the infrastructure and the development processes for putting the city in that spotlight attend to the real demands of the city, or with a long-term urban plan, for example, then the spotlight comes on, you get a lot of overbuilt infrastructure, and it goes away, and no one ever goes to Albertville again, or no one ever goes to Lillehammer in order to use the infrastructure that was built to that capacity. And
right.
So we get in places even like Athens is massively overbuilt infrastructure that has no post-games use. And this is also true in Lake Placid, in Salt Lake City, in Albertville, which was also an environmental disaster zone. And so these are hugely impactful events that
right.
bring with it a whole series, a whole constellation of infrastructure, from roads to trains to sewage to stadiums, etc., that don't necessarily articulate with the needs of the people that live there.
Hmm.
And it tends to be pro-growth coalitions led by businessmen, civil construction firms, stadium architects that want to bring these games to places like Albertville or Salzburg to then have a blank check to redesign an Olympic city that may or may not have anything to do with the city that's there already.
Okay, so, yeah, so many times that placemaking that's going involved and trying to promote this city as part of the international sort of network and bring it to that stage, sometimes it promotes it as in some kind of disconnected way from its actual local culture?
Well, frequently. I mean, there's almost, this is part of the dream of the politicians who tend to be from the elite sections of whatever city you want to think about, that they want to be considered among the international elite, and that the accumulation of political capital that the Olympics brings is a big part of what is the attraction for these events, for politicians and for wealthy individuals. And so people want to be able to rub, you know, the local mayor and the local economic elites want to be able to rub elbows with world leaders. And so they pursue the Olympics, and they gain this temporary political capital that makes them feel good about themselves. Of course, they have to use public money to do that, and they sell it through what is called kind of the patriotism of the city. And so if you're against the project, you are anti-progress. You're against your own city. You're not looking out for the welfare of all, and you're being selfish by saying, we don't want these games. What we actually do want is better roads, better schools, better hospitals, that the Olympics just don't bring. And the World Cup certainly doesn't bring. You get new stadiums, you get five-star hotels, you get a new rail line or something like that. But in Sochi, a year after the Olympics, we've seen that the rail line that was built from the center of the city to the mountain resort doesn't even connect downtown with the airport anymore. And they only run 5 trains a day, and it's being gradually sold off. And so these are temporary blasts of infrastructure that are hugely overpriced that could be built for much less money if the event weren't coming. And so if all these benefits are going to accrue to the city by hosting the Olympics, why couldn't you just spend half as much money to build those things anyway and have a much more livable city?
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. Look for us on the internet at www.geographicalimaginations.org.
So we're back with Chris Gaffney, and I want to continue with that idea here. I mean, in terms of the public support and how that kind of plays out against the political elite, let's say, it's reported that, say, here in Salzburg, that 60% of the people, and again, this is just through some research I've done, but reported that 60% of the people of the population here did not want the Olympics, but yet the city offices who were behind the bid in the candidacy went ahead with it anyways. From your experience, I wonder if that's similar to what you've seen in Brazil. And I guess the question here is too, how does that play out when the priorities, I guess, you know, because we're talking about the global north versus the global south or different ways we want to describe that. Brazil maybe having different sort of priorities in terms of where federal budgets or national budgets are directed versus maybe Salzburg, Austria. They might have a different set of priorities, maybe not that different, still looking to serve or provide basic services. Where did you see Brazil, the Brazilian population in terms of their support or where they were trying to maybe convince their government that this wasn't a good idea?
Well, there are two different elements in here. And the first one is that the event promoters, those who want the event, don't have to listen to public opinion because it's usually a very small group of people that are associated with the National Olympic Committee, the executive branch of city and state governments and with business elites. And they can push this through. In the case of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil's formerly wealthiest man put $20 million of his own money to the Olympic bid because he really wanted it. And Rio spent more money than all the other Olympic bids combined as they promoted their bid around the globe.
Just in the initial stages, just the
just
bid
the initial stage.
Stage.
It was 100 million reais, which at the time was about $55, $60 million.
Wow.
Just on the promotion of the bid. And so they had to sell it to all the, you know, so they took the volleyball players to Asia and, you know, showed the Brazilian booties around the world, and they eventually got it, especially in the wake of the financial crisis. And so it has nothing to do with initial public opinion. Once you then can mobilize, you pay for a party, you know, and so we saw when Rio won the bid, there were 300,000 people on Copacabana waiting for Rio to be selected. And again, this is something to do with city pride, a pride of place, of patriotism in the local sense. And that's very difficult to go against. What you see now, and so there are always these kind of waves of support that come with an event, so that it builds up, you're excited, you're sold the idea that you want to win the thing because you're in competition and it's good for the city and it's going to bring us all this recognition. The world's going to love us. We're a great place to have these events, or the event in case the Olympics. And you win it, and public approval is sky high. But then now, 6 years later, you see public opinion completely in the toilet about the Olympics as we realize that none of the environmental remediation projects are going to happen. The proposed transportation is five times over budget. Stadiums are dislocating people. There's massive protests. The inflation's going through the roof. Basic services are still terrible. And so now people are starting to question, well, why are we spending 50 billion or 100 billion reais on a three-week party for the rest of the world at events that no one here engages in? And so we're building temporary handball venues and fencing venues and ping pong venues and BMX and a canoe and kayak, a slalom course in the middle of a military range, man, in the middle of the worst drought in recent Brazilian history. And so how are all these things going to be of any use to a population that doesn't practice sports in the first place when we don't have schools, hospitals, roads, police, etc.?
Right.
And so once the buzz of winning the event wears off, then public opinion declines. And it'll go up again as the event approximates, as people get excited for the party, because everybody's going to be off for 3 weeks. They want to be good hosts. They don't want to air their dirty laundry to the rest of the world. And then after the event, people are going to say, well, that was definitely not worth it, because now our school, we've maxed out all our infrastructure. We've overbuilt some infrastructure, and we haven't attended to the basic needs of the society. And it's predictable. It's as predictable as it is kind of sad and really avoidable.
This is Geographical Imaginations, your tour guide into the geographies of everything and nothing. Tonight, we're on the line with Christopher Gaffney of the University of Zurich. Let's get back to our discussion with him and talk about the building of infrastructure for the mega event.
I mean, you're saying that makes, you know, creating these venues for sports that no one really actually practices in Brazil. The other side of that is, I'm thinking of like Innsbruck here in Austria, host of the Winter Olympics. People here are always going to use those venues for, and then some of those venues become part of the World Cup kind of circuit. And that's different, isn't it?
It is a bit different because it's more culturally appropriate. And when we think about the Winter Olympics and even the Summer Olympics, these are elite European and North American pastimes, and you know, Chinese as well, we can say, or Japanese, or you know, wealthy countries that dedicate themselves to the practice of sports. Most people in the world don't have the time to dedicate themselves to being amazing fencers.
Right.
It's just not, you know, when, and so the entire practice of Olympic sports, of high performance sport, is an elite practice. And when we build venues in countries like Brazil or in places like Athens that don't need these sort of things, they could have reused or used alternative venues or something, it's simply a transfer of wealth from the public to the private. And then the public has to deal with the consequences afterwards, not only in terms of maintenance of these facilities, but in paying down the debt as well. And one of the very obvious reasons for Greece's economic woes was the massive deficit spending they went into to prepare for the Olympics in 2004. And so it's not just the global south that has these problems, it's the European south.
Yeah.
And even Beijing, you know, we see the bird's nest is, you know, the birds have flown the coop. And there's nothing left in there.
So what is, yeah, the bird's nest, which became so iconic of the Beijing Games, what is it used for now?
Tourism. Or
yeah.
Your people take Segway tours around it, or they have trying to put a shopping mall in it. But they're, you know, Brazil played Argentina there a few months ago. But that was the only football game that's going to be played there this year.
Yeah, so it's not, I mean, it's not, the venues, there's not this idea, this forward-looking idea with the building. Like, we're going to build it for this now, and then it's going to be this later. Maybe some host cities do it that way? Or
Very few.
Yeah.
Because that's not the point.
Right.
The point is to maximize. It's fast. The Olympic motto is altius, sitius, fortius. Faster, stronger, higher. Or stronger, faster, higher, something like that. And it's about conquering in the short term. And so no one remembers who was the Olympic champion in the 100 meters in Athens, because those records have been broken. And so even this, so this is just the ideology of modern sport. The ideology of the Olympics is to have these explosions of these festivals and to have all these venues built for that, to make it a spectacularized environment for immediate consumption. And then what happens afterward? Well, we're on to the next place. But the reality is that the communities, the cities in which these places are hosted have to bear the burden, not only spatially, but economically and socially, because you tend to militarize cities, you build exclusive domains, you shunt undesirable people out of the spotlight, you push things under the carpet. You get rid of homeless people, you remove prostitutes, you get rid of the degraded housing in the center of the city. And this happens again and again and again. It's just part of the business model. And if we stop thinking of the Olympics as this great celebration of sport, and rather as a business model that caters to the demands of an elite European institution, then it takes on quite a different tone.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Coming to you from Salzburg, Austria at Radio Fabrik, this is episode 5, Winter Wonderland. For other episodes, check out our website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. We're back with Chris Gaffney here. I'm curious, like, we both grew up kind of watching these sports, the winter sports every 4 years. I got excited about it. I was kind of bought into the idea in 1980 as a young kid, watching Lake Placid. I can remember watching the sport and watching, for me, I think for some odd reason, bobsled was always the most exciting to me. There was something so just different about it, and at the same time I knew it was coming from the Alps. I knew it was from this other place. What happened to the Winter Olympics over time that it's made it, or any Olympic event really, like, how did we go from it being this sort of cool cultural kind of project to now being, or was that just me kind of buying into that as for the cultural part and not seeing the business side of it? Or has it really changed?
It's the same. of course, I mean, we get older and we, you know, I think we're a little bit nostalgic about those Cold War times, and that gave us, you know, national identity to beat the Russians and all that stuff coming from North America. But I think that that NBC and ABC and the major media outlets that produce and depend on this spectacle for their profit margins, and they, you know, NBC pays the IOC billions of dollars for television rights, they depend on creating that narrative. And so ice skating, you know, ice skating didn't used to be such a big deal, but that, you know, there are millions of people hooked into ice skating and the up close and personals and, you know, the Tonya Harding thing, all that stuff, you know, was good. It's a soap opera.
Yeah.
And so they craft the narrative, and that, but that narrative is not real. That narrative is a very specific one that appealed to an American audience in the 80s in a very specific way.
So which narrative? The narrative?
The narrative of, you know, the dirt, you know, the Cold War narrative was,
yeah,
very much implicated in what happened during the Winter Olympics.
Right.
Because that was, it was so much more visible than in the Summer Olympics, principally because in 80, the American team boycotted Russia. In 84, the Russians boycotted the States.
The Summer Olympics.
The Summer Olympics.
Yeah.
And so it was very, the only place we really found each other was, you know, on the playing field was in the Winter Olympics and,
right,
you know, the hockey thing and all that. And so that narrative, I think, really made the Olympics much more associated with the nation than it is now. And especially as, you know, as you learn more about the world and become more educated about how these things work, then you start to really question those basic framings. But for many people in the United States, they still think the Olympics carry, that it's one time where they can be unabashedly nationalist. And that carries a particular weight. And I think that the way that the Olympics are presented in each country reflects feelings or sentiments, or creates those sentiments about the nation. For instance, in Brazil, it's very different. You know, the Jamaican bobsled team, you know, so now the Jamaican, you know, you probably have Jamaicans watching the Winter Olympics because of their bobsled team. And that reflects something about the nation to them. And I think it still has that very powerful sentiment. But when we look at the nuts and bolts of it, we can start to take apart those discursive framings,
mm-hmm,
and look at the business behind it and the realities behind it and who, what are the interests that are driving it. And then it becomes much more complicated and you can start to be a bit more cynical about,
yeah,
the way that these things actually work.
I want to thank Chris Gaffney for joining us from Zurich to talk about hosting the Olympics, World Cup, and the politics behind these mega events, as we look at a little bit, I guess, more specifically, the Winter Olympics and its place in not only the narratives of sort of international cooperation, but narratives coming from the Olympic Committee. So thank you, Chris, for joining us. And
yeah, thank you, Kevin. It's been really great.
Great. So we've come to the end of another episode, this one, Winter Wonderland. I want to thank Dr. Christopher Gaffney for joining us from Zurich. Thank you for really helping us break through some of the rhetoric and narratives that go along with the Olympics and host city selection. I'd also like to thank the organizers of the Königssee Bobsled and Skeleton World Cup races. We were out in Königssee in mid-January, and we were doing some of the field work for this episode. A big thanks to them, really, for opening the doors and allowing us the kind of access where we were able to meet with and speak quite a bit with members of different national teams. You heard the Team USA member, Annie O'Shea. We also spoke with other Team USA members, members from Great Britain, as well as other countries. So thank you to them. I'd also like to thank Sonia Ibanez, who came out with me to Königssee to help with the technical aspects, but most importantly to
capture some of the images of the field work day at the bobsled track. And you could see some of those images online on the blog section of the website, www.geographicalimaginations.org. Some really nice images of the speed, really, and capturing kind of in that split second the speeding bobsleds going by on some of the curves. Some really nice photographic work. This episode, I think, really did one major thing for me. I think going out and kind of getting behind the curtain of something that had filled at least my childhood with, I don't know, with some really kind of interesting ways of, or at least informed a different way of looking at the world through bobsled and winter sport telecasts. That would have been my way of seeing a lot of the winter sports, was through shows like The Wide World of Sports or the Olympic broadcasts, especially every 4 years, and seeing the world or wherever that host city was through that lens and through the television broadcast and how that's packaged. And so this was really interesting to kind of see an alpine village, essentially, on the other side and being sort of in the production side of things. It demystified in some ways, I think, that experience for me in ways that I continue to think about. And along that same theme, I think we demystified a little bit the narrative a little bit about the Olympics and the Olympic spirit and where kind of that's come from and maybe gone to in the last 100 years, especially as it pertains to the sort of promise of development that goes along with hosting an event. And so, Dr. Chris Gaffney, again, thanks for your help there. And I know you've done quite a bit of research and continue to do research and will be doing so in the next few years. So thank you for your help. Without anything further, then, I'd like to wish you all a upcoming spring. Happy spring. Our March episode, our next episode, celebrating 50 years of Sound of Music, as for some of you know, that this it was filmed here in Salzburg. We'll be celebrating those 50 years as well and talking about film landscapes. So look for us then. I hope you have a great month. Ciao.